Welcome to our study in the book of Daniel. It's our 11th study, and it's Marduk's Iron Legs, or Rome. And we're only reading one verse, Daniel 2, verse 40, because that covers this fourth kingdom. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. Now these is referring to all those that came before, because that's what Rome did. It broke all those kingdoms and absorbed them as much as it could. It did not really take over the entire area that was controlled by Persia, though it did send expeditionary forces out into the nether regions. It just could not contain them. In fact, there is some archaeological evidence that Roman soldiers were taken prisoner and ended up even in China. Well, let's look at our previous three empires for a moment, just to refresh our memories. Babylonia is the head of gold. Gold never tarnishes, and Nebuchadnezzar, as we're going to see as we go through the book of Daniel, is the only one who becomes saved. Thus, his glory will never pass away. It will never tarnish, because he is indwelt with Christ. When he comes back, he'll have the new covenant like we have today. Remember, in this head, the laws were given by God and followed by man. Even in paganism, Hammurabi received the laws from his God and is just the conduit by which to administer those laws to the people. He is the final arbitrator between man and that God. Well, that's exactly what Moses was. He received the law from God. He was the arbitrator between God and the Hebrews, with their own consent in Exodus 20, I might add. And that is actually the position of Christ. He is the intercessor between man and God. Without him, there would be no salvation. Without him, there would be no eternal life of bliss. There would only be lake of fire, eternal death. And now we move on to the Medo-Persian Empire, excuse me, it's the chest and arms of silver. If you know pure silver, it tarnishes black and it rubs off on you, and it's just very messy. However, it's easily removed, revealing the luster underneath, and both pure gold and pure silver are soft. They're malleable. Usually they're mixed with other metals to harden them. But here's Persia that was known for its communication, its road system, and its adoption of the alphabet to change from cuneiform to an alphabetic type of writing system. And we saw in our studies how that was developed by Joseph of Genesis, who was sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt, how when he became the vizier, that he used aspects of the Egyptian hieroglyphic system to make a Hebrew alphabet, one of the first alphabets in the world. And then that was taken with them by Moses when the Hebrews left Egypt. That died out in Egypt, and it's seen in Canaan, picked up by all the other cultures in Canaan, and eventually through Solomon was transmitted to Phoenicia, which adopted it to their language, and from there it spread outward and comes back through Armenia into Persia. And Persia adopts it to their language, turning it into a square script. And when the Hebrews are taken captive to Babylon, which was then later conquered by Persia, they adopt the square script for their own Hebrew language. So as we saw, it came full circle. And that was necessary both to ensure that the Old Testament was written in a common tongue that could easily travel throughout the region, throughout that entire kingdom, enlightening man as to the truth and nature of God. Then we have the bronze, which is the loin and thighs. And notice, bronze is very hard. It was the metal of war, and of pots, and when it tarnishes, it has a green patina. It does not go all the way through. It just forms this kind of greenish, dullish patina that many people find delightful to look at. And this, of course, was the Grecian Empire. If we concentrate on Alexander, then we miss most of the important aspects of this empire. But basically, it comes down to the fact that while Alexander conquered Persia and Greece and Egypt and Libya and everything in between, and forming one of the largest kingdoms at the time, it was very short-lived. And on his death, it was divided between the four generals. And basically, the Bible is concerned only with the aspects of two of them, the Seleucids of Syria in that region and the Ptolemies of Egypt. But really, Hellenism did something remarkable. It took the paganistic beliefs of everyone that it came in contact with and morphed them into a secular philosophy. And it developed, of course, allegorism, which interpreted their own mythologies into a secular aspect. And so it began to seed the world with both the allegorism and its rationalism, which made man the measure of all things. So it was breaking man away from paganism, but not to God. Because the sinful mind is an ungodly mind, and that's the Baha mind, and refuses the truth of God willingly. And that brings us to today's lesson, the legs of iron. Well, rust rots. When iron rusts, it rusts all the way through. Once it starts, it never stops until it crumbles. And this is important for us to understand. Yes, it's a very hard metal. It replaced bronze for weapons and stuff. But iron, the harder a metal is, the more brittle it becomes. Yes, it can break and shatter all things, but in itself, due to its hardness, it too is brittle, and with the right blow, is easily shattered. Now, Rome is divided throughout its history. It has obscure origins, as we'll see, and implemented admired qualities from other cultures. And it took the Hellenistic man is the measure of all and morphed it into man is God. The government crumbled due to relativism, just like rust. It was eaten up right from the very beginning. And it became the foundation of Western culture, from America to modern Russia. Now, we're going to go through these, excuse me, and we're going to cover them from a historical prospect, because Rome really does not come into view in the scriptures until the Gospels, and then throughout the New Testament. So if we're going to understand its place in the New Testament, and we're only going to be able to look at that briefly, then we must have a working but brief knowledge of Rome. And to do that, we must start at the beginning, of course. Now, its origins are shrouded in myth, and reality shows cultural appropriation, to use a modern phraseology. We would be condemning Rome today, the social justice warriors, because Rome copied everybody. And what they liked, they made Roman. But this obscured Rome's origins. See, Rome's self-proclaimed origin myth, Romulus and Remus, was developed in about the 3rd century BC. But archaeological digs show that Rome itself started as a Etruscan village in about the 8th century, around 750 BC thereabouts. And so this Romulus and Remus suckled by a she-wolf, with Rome founded by Romulus after killing Remus, is nothing more than an attempt to legitimize the foundation of Rome. Remember, man always sought to justify the creation of his culture, the philosophical and religious foundations of his morality with God. Now, we don't do that today. In the same way. We don't tie it back to a God. We tie it back to ourselves. And we point back to the Greeks, but the Greeks only started the process. Rome finished that process. Greek philosophy said, man is the measure of all things. Roman philosophy said, man is God. And of course, in the Enlightenment, Rousseau built on this and says, I'm conscious. I think, therefore I am. I exist. But notice here that it's a violent myth. It's an appeal to violence. And certainly Rome was a violent empire. They weren't alone. As we've seen, all the empires, stretching even into the antediluvian period under Cain and his descendants, were steeped in violence. Because violence, degradation, and death, based on lies, are the hallmarks of sin. But actually, the origins of Rome are much more mundane. Rome began as an Etruscan village settled by foreigners. Now, we know they're foreigners because Etruscans did not have an Indo-European language. It had a different source. But those who settled in this Etruscan village did have an Indo-European type language, which morphed into Latin. Where'd they come from? Nobody knows. What were the customs? Nobody knows. And nobody knows because they copied the Etruscans in many things. Now, the village itself is laid out in the Etruscan fashion, on a hill overlooking a river and laid out in a certain direction according to augury and interpreting the flights of birds, so on and so forth. And we know about the Etruscans because they traded with the Grecian cities both around the Italian peninsula as well as in Greece itself, and they had an advanced culture. And this was discovered in the necropolises that predated similar Roman practices. So the monarchy period was not Roman. It was Etruscan. The kings had Etruscan names. And in fact, the kings were not a hereditary monarchy, but they were voted in. And so when a king died, his successor had to compete with others who wanted that position, and they underwent an interrogatum, and then it had to be approved by the augurs, the priests, and then they, if selected and voted on by the powers that be, they were voted into kingship for life. This had a terrific influence on those other peoples. Because when the Romans rebelled to create their own government, it was based on election. And they called it a republic, which just means a public affair. It wasn't going to be vested in one person anymore, as we're going to see. So the republic based itself on the Etruscan tradition of electing its leaders. And I want to say that these origin myths depicting this divine support and the foundation which legitimized their government after the rebellion to prevent rebellion against itself became the pattern for Americans today. Because U.S. was a colony of Britain, primarily, rebelled against that, fought a war in rebellion against that, and developed a constitution, which we're going to see is actually a Roman practice, to legitimize the rebellion and prevent future rebellions, which is why Lincoln fought a war and a rebellion that he precipitated. That's American history, not Bible history. But how about the two legs? Let's see if we can understand this. How about the one leg is Etruscan? Rome was a chameleon, as it adopted significant aspects of Etruscan culture for its own, like the fasces, the symbol of authority, the bundle of rods with around the axe, which symbolized government authority to either beat you or execute you. That was brought into the 20th century, not by Hitler, because Hitler was German. He would have had no clue about any of this. It was brought into the 20th century by Mussolini, who was trying to elevate Italian culture and legitimize Italian socialistic, nationalistic rule over communism. So he saw the fasces and developed his own type of national socialistic government, which he called fascism. But it didn't come from Rome. It came from Etruscans, the Romans, as we've come to call them, whomever they were, adopted it. Also adopted the gods, but morphed them to fit their culture, which is very common since everybody comes from a common foundation at Babel, and we find that there are common gods and goddesses with somewhat similar names, but slightly different, somewhat different, and what they do, or claim to represent, were somewhat different from culture to culture. In Etruscan, Tinea was the head god, whereas in Roman culture, it was Jupiter. But Tinea could not just arbitrarily decide to take action and punish people. He had to get approval from his council. But Jupiter was running amok all the time, in many ways. Tinea had his consort, Uni, but they were viewed as near equals. In fact, women in the Etruscan society were near equals with the men, sat with the men, reclined with the men, which was unheard of in both Hellenistic and Roman cultures. There the women were citizens, but citizens without rights. And of course, Jupiter was constantly running amok on Juno. And that, of course, with the rape of Europa, who was a Phoenician, which produced the people of Crete, which later, as we saw, that was Minoan culture, morphed into the Mycenaean culture in the mainland of Greece, that then became Hellenism, and then that philosophy spread throughout Europe, but it spread throughout Europe because of the Roman Empire, which carried all things Greek and Roman with it. The augury, or haruspicy, the ability to read organs, especially the liver, was Etruscan. But it was copied by the Romans, and not only that, that practice persisted into the medieval period. Sitting as a symbol of authority began with the Etruscans, as we can see in their necropolises, that the Romans developed into the judgment seat, or bema seat, which is even in scripture. Notice Pilate sat when he pronounced judgment on Christ. You do not stand, you sit. When you're exercising authority, you are sitting. If you attend a military courts-martial, the judges are sitting. The accused is standing. That all goes back to Etruscan. Etruscans developed aqueducts and sewage systems that the Romans copied and later developed. Only they added a twist. Rather than stone, they developed concrete. And that's the technology that we still use today. And of course, the chariot races and gladiatorial games had Etruscan origins, were adopted and expanded on by the Romans, and are even existent in today's Western cultures in the form of sports. How about the other leg, Hellenism? Romans greatly influenced, or were influenced by Hellenism during the Republic period, because they were expanding outward. The Romans' pantheon of gods took on Greek coloration with Latin names. Thus, Greek Zeus actually became Latin Jupiter. And the Roman army was based on Etruscan model, probably, and that's the only example they had. But they quickly rejected the heroic warrior, which was really the essence of not only Etruscan, but also Hellenistic combat. You call out your hero, the enemy calls out their hero, they battle it out, and whoever wins takes all. Or you're fighting unit tactics, one army against another army, and you break formation to prove how brave you are, and so on and so forth. It's not a best way of fighting, and the Romans rejected that outright. But they did adopt the Greek phalanx. Now, the phalanx required discipline to stay in the ranks. It moved as a solid unit. It was not very flexible. And during its Republic period, the Roman army developed the maniple, which fought as brothers in arms, and probably became the first army to develop small unit tactics. So you had units of various sizes that were made up of smaller units and smaller units. And Napoleon built upon this concept and made the modern army division, which could fight separately as a unit, opposed to smaller units, and several divisions could then come together to form an army. Thus you could march them along separate routes of advance, so they would not strip one part of the land bare, but they could spread out, because in those days, armies, armies foraged that lived off the land. Romans adopted the Greek alphabet to Latin, and as we saw, it was first developed by the Hebrews, picked up by the Phoenicians, and adapted by the Greeks. Hellenistic philosophy greatly influenced Rome. Man, the measure of all, which in Rome became, under the empire, man as God. See, they had no original concept except for these forms of worship. The Hellenistic artistry became popular in Rome. In the form of these stone statues, frescoes, etc. And to the surprise of most people, these were not separate occupations. These were done by slaves. So not all slaves did brutal, back-breaking labor. Often, they were made stewards of the house, educators of children, of the rich, artisans, so on and so forth. And as we saw, even Joseph was a slave his entire life, even though he was second in command. When he went to bury his father, Jacob, in the land, an army went with him to make sure that he came back, that he did not stay there and form his own nation. That's why there's an army with him. Not just as an honor guard, but also to make sure he came back where he's supposed to be. Rome was the first empire we've seen with a definitive cultural hegemony. Who were they? We don't know. Who were the Babylonians? Well, we know that. Who were the Persians? We know that. Who were the Greeks? From the Dorian invasion from Anatolia, we have a good idea of that. Who were the Romans? Nobody knows. What distinguished them? They could copy. They were very, very good at copying. The Roman Republic, a quick overview, very quick. Now, the elements of the Roman Republic influenced the West. That's today's Western culture. And we're going to see the extent of it and why. See, the Republic was never a democracy. You hear this mantra constantly today that we trace democracy back to Athens. No, we don't. I've shown in our last lesson where Plato and Aristotle, the two later major philosophers, hated democracy. And everybody since them hated democracy. The founding fathers hated democracy. Nobody liked democracy. When you hear democracy today, you're being sold a bill of goods. And most people swallow it because they're ignorant. They were taught in the public school system to believe what they wanted you to believe. And it's only when you leave that system and start studying on your own that you begin to understand true history. So it was never a democracy. Not in Rome, not in Greece. It was an oligarchy, a rule by the few, of the powerful cultured elites, the nobles. Now in Rome, these nobles were formed from three main tribes. There are others, but three main tribes held the reins of power. And these became the patricians, or the fathers, the patra. Now their government had three branches to balance power. Now you get some discussion on what these three branches were, and according to the Roman Republic's three branches of government, one branch was the Senate, which represented the noble families. and they were to advise the consuls, and they controlled the budgets. There were the committees, and these actually passed the laws and represented, they had two assemblies or committees, Comitia Centuriata, which were the patricians, and later on they had the Consilium Plebis, which represented the plebeians, who were wealthy and kind of like the upper middle class. And they were from the other tribes. And they wanted into the power structure because they brought in manufacturing and business and trading, and that made them wealthy. And they said, we got money, you want taxes, you want the money, you're going to have to give us a say in government. And they did have a say. And then you had the consuls. These were chosen by the patricians, and they served for 1 year. They could serve other years, but not consecutively. And there were two of them, and they acted as the political and military heads of state. And you had two that could veto each other to prevent despotism. And they were answerable for their decisions at the end of the year. So if you made a decision nobody liked, you'd be executed. I bet you more presidents would be careful, a lot more careful if that was in effect. But then it took a few hundred years to wreck that system. And we're going to see why. But the magistrates were a subset of the councils. These were the bureaucracy, but also the judicial. And so you had the Senate, you had the committees, which would act as our house, and then you had the councils, which were the executive judicial arm. So you see how we copied from Rome. And the writers of the Constitution did that on purpose. They were well aware of all of this. Now, Rome was governed by unwritten and written practices. The unwritten were precedents. What had gone on before? What had been done before? In this form, today, we would call it common law. And you were going to be bound by what had been decided earlier, pretty much. And even today, precedence is broken whenever convenient. But they also had written documentation that they could consult. And it was religious in nature. We would consider it long and rambling, but they would go and consult it. So they had a constitution with written and unwritten portions that was the foundation of their government. They could point back to it and say, you can't do that because, and then they would go point it out. It was the breaking of this that led from the Republic to the Empire, or the reinterpretation of it, I might add. How about Rome? Expansionism. Well, that was through wars. Rome was nearly constantly in war, and it mirrors, in some of these issues, even mirrors today's Middle East crisis, as we'll see. See, Rome aggressively expanded its control through wars or intimidation or both. Rome conquered the Italian peninsula, finally. Those subjugated cities were still inferior to Rome. We're still working on a city-state kind of model. Rome, I don't think, ever saw itself as a nation as we would define that. That is going to be a post-medieval concept, this nation-state idea. How about the Punic Wars against Carthage, which was a Phoenician colony? It was basically for control of trade, control of trade to North Africa, but also to the Western Mediterranean. Rome did not want to be beholden to anybody. And it was three separate campaigns over a long period of time before Carthage was finally, literally, utterly destroyed. And so those cultures that they did not want to appropriate, they either subjugated or eliminated. And thus, through this intimidation, this threat of war, they captured Egypt, which became the breadbasket of Rome. And that's going to be important, as we're going to see. Through wars, Rome gained Iberia, which is Spain, Gaul, France, Hellene, which is Greece, and Anatolia, or Turkey, and extended into Persian regions. At least they tried. They tried to do that. Through diplomacy and annexation, Rome gained the Levant, including Judah. And they installed Herod the Great as king of Judah with a Roman army. And just as the Egyptians did, the Roman army was there to help Herod, but more so to help Rome. Just so you know, if Herod decided that he didn't want to be a part of Rome anymore, he wouldn't have been king. And Herod really understood this. See, the Herods were Idumeans. Now, we use that word today, but Nabateans is what they would have been known as back then. And we say Petra was an Edom, but the Edomites had really passed out of existence by that time. The Nabateans had moved into the area, conquered them, and morphed into the Idumeans. Now, these were forcibly converted to Judaism during the Maccabean Revolt. And it's ironic that the Idumeans came to rule over the Jews. And so, be careful what you do. Sword of evangelism is not God's method. It's works. And you may not like the results. Like the medieval Ashkenazi or Khazars Jews, who largely, though not totally, morphed in today's atheistic, socialistic Jews, who formed Israel as a Zionist state. And from that has come today's Middle East issues. Are we beginning to see a pattern here? That all things, many things today are not new? Like Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. Satan copies and copies and recopies and recycles and recycles and recycles. Because he's trapped in his sinful nature. Just like all sinners are. Roman citizenship is the basis of modern citizenship. There was no such concept, really. You belong to a culture. You belong to a king. Pretty much you were Egyptian because you were under the Egyptian king and you were of that ethnicity and had that culture and had that religion, and your salvation and your morality was tied to that culture, to that religion, through that king who was priest or at least was an intercessor with the priests. So Rome developed this unique concept of citizenship to legally differentiate citizens of Rome, Romans, from others. And it gave them unique rights, responsibilities, and suffragium, or the right to vote. And that is where the word suffrage came from. The women's suffrage movement See, people were more cultured back then, and they understood that suffrage came from Latin and meant to vote. Today, you read it and you go, I don't know. It's just a name. But it's not. It has a meaning. And by adopting that, they were saying they wanted the right to vote. Now, first, it was limited to the patricians. Like I said, it meant fathers. But later was extended to the plebeians who agitated for rights based on their contribution of wealth and power. And just so you know, Caesar was a patrician. And we're going to throw a little, scatter these little tidbits throughout because we need to have an understanding. But you notice I'm trying to talk fast to get through this volume of material because it's important, but I don't want to spend weeks going through each one. Now, citizenship did not mean equality. Let's not confuse the two concepts. Quality, as we use the term today, was unknown in the ancient world. And we're still debating what equality means today. The politerae, which meant the producing ones or the workers, and Marx was quite right in using that term, and he translated it correctly. The proletariat are the workers. But if you don't know Latin, you don't know that. And thus you become trapped by your own ignorance. And it just becomes a label that you bandy about. These were the poorest class, but they were voting citizens. All that sounded familiar? Thus, they were above slaves and foreigners who did not have citizenship. So when you were a politati, you had something to cling to. You had some reason to support Rome. It gave you meaning. You could go down and vote. Didn't mean much. And there are books written today about, yes, everybody has the right to vote. Everybody can go down and vote. Individual votes mean almost nothing. Statistically, they're absolutely insignificant. And if you control the means of information, you can negate whole blocks that you do not like to achieve the result that you really wanted. And that is even more true today in the internet computer age. But I want you to know that, yes, you had certain rights and privileges, but you were not a patrician. You were not going to be at the same level. And a plebeian was never going to be a patrician, and a proletarii was never going to be a patrician or plebeian. But everybody was happy-ish where they were because they were above somebody else. The workers could look and say, see, I'm above the slave. I can vote. I can come and go if I want. No matter how good that slave had it, you were still considered above that slave. Now, some people could buy their citizenship, and we see this in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 22, verse 22 through Acts 23:11. You see this dialogue between Paul and a Roman soldier. Now, Roman soldier said, I had to buy my citizenship. And it was expensive. You don't look like a whole lot of rich here, bud. How'd you get yours? Oh, you just lied to me and we're going to beat you anyway. Paul said, I was born one. Get out of here. And he was. You could buy your citizenship. Sometimes Rome extended citizenship to conquered Italian peoples, certain ones, to secure its borders. Hey, we'll let you be Romans-ish. But you don't get to vote in Rome. You get to vote where you're at, but you can't come to Rome and vote. You're going to be citizen of Rome and of this empire, but it's going to have some limitations. And military duty could gain citizenship. And when they started bringing non-Romans into the Roman army, this was the lure. If you serve long enough, you and don't die, you can be a Roman citizen. And this became greatly prized and ultimately led to the downfall of Rome itself. Because the barbarians would, oh, they loved Rome. They loved everything Roman, interpreted through their own ways. And when Rome would withhold that citizenship, they can take Rome. So you want to be that way? Well, we'll show you power. And what happened to Rome basically is it just faded away. It wasn't defeated per se. It was sacked a couple of times. But it literally, the empire just ceased to govern and Rome faded. And the concept of citizenship even passed to children. Now we have that today because we copied things Roman. At least America did. Not every nation does that. Paul was born Roman and Jewish like his father. One did not negate the other. So you could be Roman and a citizen of where you live at. And when you traveled, you took that with you. Now today it's much more formal. You have to have passports, you have papers, so on and so forth. The Republic disintegration and the rise of imperial order. See, Rome's Republic lacked the ability to bring peace to Rome like they ever wanted to. An Italian peninsula due to political intrigues, murders, and riots. You can make all the laws you want to. You can't control sinful nature. The more laws you make, the more you reveal the sin nature. Romans chapter 7. Sinners always seek power for self, and no safeguards can prevent this. None. Republican government became increasingly ineffective. It became mired in controversy. Does this sound familiar today? It sounds very familiar today. Certain consuls sought to increase their power by increased liberty to the proletarii, but this was defeated, which resulted in more social breakdown. Very modern pattern. Only back then, they just execute those consuls. Once they left office, they just execute them. But you won't be doing that one again. And we're almost on the verge of that today. And there's very strong evidence that America has already engaged in presidential assassination to remove the people that were seen as a danger to power structures. So we are no different. Julius Caesar definitely orchestrated his election as Magister Populi, or dictator. Now this was legitimate in ancient Rome. You could be elected dictator for 6 months. You had absolute power. And they did this in times of great emergency. And at the end of 6 months, people would lay it aside, like George Washington did. That was the example he was following. However, Caesar manipulated the Senate into voting him that title for life, and the patrician Senate revolted and murdered him. And of course, we had another Roman civil war. Yet his name became a title that endured to the 20th century. Now, violence begets violence, resulting in, like I said, this civil war, where Caesar's adopted son Octavius won, resulting in his election as not Magister Populi. He says, no, we don't want to go for that one because that's dangerous. You died with that title. He says, Principus. That'd be better. That's low-keyed. That has that humble appearance. So I'll be Principus. And I said, yeah, we like that. You be Principus for life. Now, from that Latin word, we get the word prince and we get the word principles. But what it meant to the Romans was you were the first citizen for life. You were number one. But you're a dictator in name. You were in reality, but not in name. And sometimes that's all it takes. Imperial order, imperial religion. Now, Augustus, which was his name afterwards, it means the August one, the first one. So Octavius was known still as Octavius, but he took on the title of Augustus once he was made Principus, because that's what Augustus means, the first citizen. Accepted the Senate title and sought to restore declining Roman morality by resurrecting the public's paganism. So he was looking back and saying, how can I solidify my position? Because there's a maxim, Sanders' first law of human relationships. If you confuse people, they will get even. Whether they intend to or not, they will get even. So he decided, I'm not going to make a lot of changes like my adopted father did, because that did not work well for him. Instead, I'm going to hearken back to the old days. And we're going to change him a bit. He took on the office of Pontifex Maximus, which just means the chief priest in Latin. Now, in the Republic, this was a separate office. But in Etruscan monarchy, it was the same as the king. The king was the chief priest, the Pontifex Maximus. And after his death, Augustus was deified, following Hellenistic and Mesopotamian cultures, resulting in a new imperial religion, emperor worship. Thus, many other religions were allowed, including the mystery religions. If, and this is important, if the incense offering was made to the emperor, it was usually an annual affair, because it was a sign of allegiance to Rome. Refusal meant rebellion, and thus execution. Thus, Rome legalized worship of man as God. They deliberately did this. It began with equality to other gods, because there was the pantheon. He was just a part of that pantheon of Jupiter and Juno and so on and so forth. But it became the deciding factor between life and death, so without saying it, he became the most important god to you, because if you did not burn that pinch of incense and get your little note saying you've done that, you're going to be executed, either on the spot, in the games, gladiatorial games, they weren't going to go well for you, because you're the one who doesn't get the sword and the shield. And this was a problem for the Christians because they could not worship any man, only Christ. And they would refuse to do this. And thus the persecutions. Because it was seen as rebellion against Rome itself, which is why it was not an approved religion once they understood that it was separate from Judaism. Not really. It grew out of Judaism. The Judaism said, we have nothing to do with this. And finally convinced Rome of that under Nero, and thus that's when persecutions began. And of course, one of those who lost their lives was Paul. Now that we've covered some of the basics, and we have a commonality of understanding, let's look at Rome in the Bible, which is only in the New Testament. You know, Pilate was an equeses, or an equestrian. And you go, another label? Another name? I thought there were only patricians, plebeians, and politerae. Yeah, well, they developed another one, the equestrians. These were part of the military cavalry under the Republic. But in the Imperium Army, they actually became bureaucrats and was hereditary. And so they were kind of stuck between the patricians and the plebeians. And they were primarily Grecian in background. Because remember, Alexander the Great developed great horse cavalry. Or his father did, and he used it to defeat Persia and everybody else he came in contact with. But it gave him this sense of entitlement. Pilate viewed the Jews' monotheism as inferior. He viewed them as inferior. He displayed, with the usual bureaucratic attitude, superior inflexibility, which made for poor diplomacy. He's probably not the best person to be in that position, or at least in that area. And recent power changes in Rome made him insecure. And when you're insecure in Rome, in the Roman Empire, you were going to die. In fact, 3 or 4 years after this, Pilate was summoned to Rome and had to give an account. And his backers were not in power anymore. And he ended up having given the option of execution or self-inflicted suicide, and supposedly he chose the latter. And here was Pilate, who acted like a military police bully. He mingled the blood of Jews with their offerings. He was brutal. And this caused him to be censored by Rome. And we know this because of other documents. That's not in the scripture. But this is the background. So you have to study history to be able to properly interpret the scriptures. But Luke 13:1 shows that Pilate mingled the blood of Jews, and Christ is making an example of this, so that those Jews were no worse than any other Jews. Now, the Jews were astute politicians. You gotta give them that. They understood his insecure position and manipulated him into executing an innocent man, Christ. No king but Caesar, they shouted, even the high priest. No king but Caesar. Yes. See, this is the point of Pilate's and Rome's discussion with Christ. What is truth? See, Pilate was an official of the Roman government. He was speaking for Rome. When he sat there and he made his pronouncements, he was speaking for Rome. Now, Rome may decide they didn't like the way he spoke and remove him, but he is still speaking for Rome when he's doing that. And Rome never disavowed this execution. So, Pilate was speaking in a position of authority. He was the mouth of Rome. And that was the question, what is truth? And that is going to morph down to the next kingdom, our next lesson, when we get to it. But which truth? Which God? See, created in God's image, man worships. Man is compelled to develop a basis for morality, for right and wrong, but not God's truth. See, man's truth is law, and governments force their truth, their law, onto others. Even today, that is what we do. That is what governments always do. It's sword evangelism. Romans 1, 18 through 25. You look at that and you see that Asthabea, the ungodly, the lost person, rejects everything of God, but they have to have something on which to base this because it is their nature. We are compelled to. Even atheists, which rejects all knowledge of God. In other words, they're fooling themselves. Develop their own basis of morality. That is their religion, because that is what a religion is. The values, the justification of your values of right and wrong. And sin might makes right. That is its mantra, and it's been shown ever since Cain and Abel. Actually, it was there between man and woman, because man threw woman directly under that bus right off the bat. You want me to execute her for you? I can do that, because it's her fault. If she had done that, I'd have been all right. But Scripture says that she was deceived, but Adam knew exactly what he was doing. And so, here are the beginnings of imperator worship, or emperor worship. See, Pilate is confronted with one who claimed deity, but evidenced no trappings of power to command his allegiance. Now, when I say the beginnings of imperator worship, this is still 33 AD. This is still a new concept. Everyone has to get used to worshiping a man. And I think if you talk to the Romans of that time period, they would say, I don't worship. 100 years later, when your life depended on it, you'd be burning that incense faster than they could give it to you. Because you won't be executed on the spot. He wanted to go in the games without a sword. See, Pilate agreed with the Jewish hierarchy, which looked for one with power, a conquering Messiah who ruled via fear and death, because guess what? That's what Satan does. And all sinners are of Satan, their father, John 8:44. We know that. But we also know that the main trade of Lucifer, who became Satan. Those are just titles, you have to remember. They're not names, they're titles. It's violence. Ezekiel 28:15-16. That is how he works. He'll claim peace. But he lies. Sinners lie. They may genuinely believe their lies. They're still lying. That wife who wouldn't bruise her foot, she's so dainty, will lie to your face and throw you under that bus in a heartbeat to get her own way. Trust me. And you know something? If you're lost, you'd be doing the same thing. And if you're a Christian and tempted to sin, guess what? You and Adam got a lot in common. And guess who a woman tried to throw under the bus? Yep. Satan. Everybody's trying to throw somebody under that bus. There's somebody worse than I am. But it's not about that. It's about you and your condition. See, Christ conquered death for people, for sinners. But this is beyond man's comprehension. Because man never comprehended that God would die for people. People are supposed to be dying for God. That, in essence, is religion works. But Christ has absolute power. He doesn't need you to do anything for him. Because, number one, you can't. Number two, you sin, so it's not going to matter anyway. That's why he came to save sinners. Those who accept his gift of life. So, what is the essence of iron? Well, it's inherently weak. Pontius Pilate was quintessential Roman, militaristic, proud, superior, and possessor of the only truth that mattered.
Roman truth.
But what was Roman truth? Rome had no intrinsic truth. It was a compilation of adapted cultures, cobbled together, bringing everyone under its dominion by force and intimidation. That's why it says it crushes all it comes in contact with. And those it viewed as competitors, though too different to assimilate, it eliminated, like Carthage. The only power, the only worship, and the only truth that mattered was Kaiser. And that is how you pronounce it in Latin. It's a hard K sound, Kaiser. And that's going to sound familiar to most of our ears. This made Rome inwardly weak, as evidenced by its many internal wars and conflicts, which required diluting Roman citizens with barbarians whose priorities were to appear as Romans, but were in fact not Romans. No Roman allegiance. None. And like iron that breaks in pieces, it is inherently susceptible to rust, which destroys its integrity. So here you have this picture of a metal that is outwardly tremendously strong, but brittle. And it breaks everything into pieces, but just the water of the word of truth. The water of any other philosophy. And it starts eroding. And that's what sin does. It erodes the person. It erodes all truth. It erodes everything. Until you have nothing. And that's the problem. And legs attached to the body via the loins and thighs. Rome is not an independent entity. Of all the empires we've studied, it is the least independent. It is the most dependent on those that preceded it, since it had nothing. They were groveling in the dirt in that little village sitting on the hill overlooking the Tiber until they started copying from the Etruscans and finally beat them, and then started copying from the Greeks, finally beat them, and then started copying from other people around them and finally beat them and secured the Italian peninsula and so on and copied the alphabet from the Phoenicians and then defeated Carthage, the colony of, you know. Every time it came and borrowed something, it defeated the culture it borrowed from. And those cultures it didn't borrow anything from, it would eliminate them anyway. That's what Rome did. Rome did not bring people into the capital like Nebuchadnezzar did or Cyrus did to augment and expand the knowledge of his court. No. He brought him in to hold him as hostage. So if you didn't do what we wanted you to do, we'd kill these people. We'd execute them, sons, daughters. That was all that Rome knew. See, belief of man as God could not have become a reality without Hellenistic philosophy that envisioned man as the measure of all. Hellenism gave Rome the copier legitimacy of rule by oligarchy and inspired even Marcus Aurelius to become Plato's philosopher king. But you know something? His son, Commodus, saw himself as the god Hercules Romulus and fought in the arena as a gladiator. So much so, Romans were just so offended that eventually his gladiatorial trainer was told, go kill him. Okay, if you don't kill him, we're going to kill you. You got options. You always have options. You may not like your options, but you have options. Gladiatorial trainer had options. Die? or kill this idiot. He says, okay, that's not a hard choice. Rome took what others gave, roads, aqueducts, military tactics, improving them on a grand scale which impressed every culture, both in their present and in their future, even today. Everything Roman became everyone's goal, yet all hated Rome's superiority and eventually destroyed Rome's exclusivism. Now remember, the Eastern Empire, which survived another 1,000 years, was not Latin. It was Greek. It was Byzantium. Oh, they claimed to be Roman, just like the barbarians that kept invading Rome in the 5th century claimed to be Roman, because they wanted Roman citizenship and all things Roman, but they weren't. Rome festered during medievalism. It never died. It just percolated throughout like yeast. But it was revived in Western culture and governments during the Renaissance. See, Western culture and Americanism. Renaissance revived classical Greco-Romanism, which morphed into the Enlightenment, giving new life to government and philosophical concepts. New nation states sought legitimacy from Roman Catholicism, which dated back to Rome, via Protestantism and state religions, which also suppressed detractors. Yep. If I don't like what you're saying, it's not what I want, I'm going to kill you. And that's exactly what they did. That's how America kind of got settled to begin with. U.S. founders legitimized their new government, basing it on the Declaration of Independence, which is really underpinned by Greco-Roman philosophies, bronze and iron. America's classically educated founding fathers sought to copy many aspects of Roman government, including a constitution to control power. The balance of power between three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial, came from Rome. Expansion of American citizenship also followed Roman practice or precedents, limited to its members, male members, but gradually expanding as wars demanded greater support. And you can see that in American history quite clearly. And one final Roman gift, socialism. Now, it didn't begin with them. We see it in the Bronze Age and in various cultures. But their influence didn't survive the Dark Age, the Bronze Dark Age. But Rome's influence formed the foundation of almost every government on the planet today. See, Imperium Rome saddled with a burgeoning problem. And that was mob rule. They had this problem of democracy, which Plato and Aristotle rejected. See, many displaced persons gravitated to Rome for government help. And they became a rule unto themselves, which could barely be contained. Imperium Rome often devalued its currency and fixed grain prices to supply the mob with cheap or free bread as a means of control. Now, by and large, this is welfare socialism. And so all these programs are not new. All these practices are not new. And they're only done so the government can gain more power. But the farmers, not able to obtain market value for the crops, either created black markets, which were suppressed by the government, point of death, or left farms to come to Rome for free bread. In other words, they're going to join the welfare state. Now, this is a problem. Without farmers, Rome became increasingly desperate to avert famines. Thus, Rome had passed laws tying farmers to the land. This instituted the practice of feudalism, serfdom. In other words, it became a kind of slavery, because that's what serfdom is. You have no choice. You have to stay there. And the most brutal work throughout all history has been agriculture. It flows right from the consequence of sin of Adam and also of Cain. You shall spend the rest of your life resting, wrestling a living from the land. And by and large, that's what that is. And unless you can enslave a lot of people and force them to work for you, you're going to be down there in the mud doing your 30 acres. See, Western socialism rose again in the French to Soviet revolutions and remains in the forms of national and international socialisms today. It has not gone anywhere. Legacy of Rome, the failure of strength. Rome gave the world many goals to aspire. The title of Kaiser became the Russian Tsar. They abbreviated it. In German, Kaiser. That predates Hitler, just so you know. Hitler never used that title with himself. Medieval monarchies and feudalism kept everyone imprisoned in ignorance. Why? Because you had nobles, patricians, and plebeians who were landowners, and you had serfs who were working the land. We had patricians who owned vast tracts of land. You had the patricians, the plebeians, who were then your lesser nobles, who had subdivided that land into their own, and everybody had serfs or slaves working under them, and you paid each other with produce. Except the serfs, they got to eat what they could eat, but by and large, they didn't get much. This is what we're going back to. See, through Augustine's worship of Platonism and Romanism, Roman Catholicism gained dominance and hid the true gospel during the Dark Ages. What do you need to call Dark Ages? Because the light of the gospel was hid. New nation states were militaristic, expansionistic oligarchies, increasingly using democratic mob rule to solidify socialist policies, ensuring a return to serfdom. And that has continued today. Only now the people are not fighting against it, they are embracing and fighting for it. Imperator worship is expressed in Washington's apotheosis in America's capital. The American government deified George Washington. I mean, you tour the Capitol, just look up, and the apotheosis is him sitting in the heavens with the gods, looking down on people. If you go, I believe it's the Senate, might be the House, you'll see symbols of the fascists. You see George Washington's statue in a Roman toga. We have become the new Rome. Militarism for right is the maxim, justifying use of force to expand culture. Isn't that what America does? Use military force to bring democracy to people? I.e., if man is God, then all are gods. War decides which God is the right God. That's primarily the reason that wars are fought. Now, Christians, the worst of all people, are torn between two gods because we are double-minded. One foot in the world, one foot in heaven, the new nature in the old flesh. And if you don't study, and you don't seek to grow, and you don't look guidance from the Holy Spirit, you're torn between two gods. And Christians are often torn between allegiance to government and to God. It often appears they equate the Bible equal or inferior to the Constitution. It's based on poor hermeneutical interpretation of Paul's writing in Romans 13, 1 through 7, which says the government is doing right. Don't rebel. Well, rebellion is a sin of witchcraft. You're taught constantly throughout the Bible to never rebel. God did not bring the Hebrews out of Egypt through rebellion. Pharaoh said, get them out of here. He gave his permission. God asked permission. Then he had a contest of gods to see whose God was gone. Well, that's exactly Satan doing the same thing throughout history. And it'll have exactly the same end. He will lose. See, Christians are not to rebel against good government, but neither are we to support the wrongs of good government. As Peter and John talked about in Acts chapter 4, 13 through 20. You tell us not to preach about Christ? Well, you judge whether we should obey God or obey man. Now, if you take a very simplistic approach, it looks like Scripture's contradicting Scripture, but that is not what it's doing at all. It's saying that government comes from God. We will obey God's government, and we will obey man's government as long as it is in concert with God's good government. Now, we will not rebel against man's government because there's no way to institute God's government. God has to come and do that himself. That is the millennial kingdom. And guess what? It ends in utter failure. Because sinners of the world rise up in rebellion against it. The lost express their naturalness. Sin succumbing to Satan's delusion. They did it then. They did it in the beginning. They're doing it now. And they're going to do it when they rise up worldwide and march on Christ, who's there in bodily form. They can see him. The saved have the new nature of Christ in the body of flesh. And we are to live as he lived. That is our injunction. He is our example in all things. Remember, Satan has yet one more kingdom, the strongest but weakest, yet future even to us. Thank you.